California as our speaker.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bill, and I am an alcoholic. And I want to say straight away that I am very, very happy to be right here, right now, with all you guys and gals. You're the only kind of people that when I'm with you, I don't feel nervous. Because I know I'm with people who know what it's like to be nuts the way I'm nuts. And I don't have to apologize for it. And I don't give a damn whether you like me or not. And it's lovely to be with people like that. And also, the reason I like to be with you guys and gals is you keep me sober. You keep me sober and happy most of the time. Most of the time. And I'm happy tonight. And who wouldn't be happy in this lovely weather? Isn't it amazing for Christmas time? 80 degree temperature around here? God, it's fantastic. Well, now, I've talked to you long enough already to make you realize that I was not born in the United States. This is an honest program. So I'm telling you that straight away. What the hell is wrong with this thing here? Nail it down there. Nail it down. Will it stay that way now? I doubt it. I don't know. I thought I was drunk at first because it was waving on me. Is it okay now? Okay, well, thanks very much. Now, what did I say? Oh, yeah. I was not born in the United States, but I was born. I was born a long, long way away from here. Would any of you guess where? Do you know where? Oh, you're smart. You're smart. That's right. And that is a long time ago. You know, I left there a long time ago. I'll tell you about that and I'll tell you my story. But I go back sometimes. I was back there a year last September. And I was wondering, would it have changed much since I was a kid? But when I was back there last September, I was in the capital city. That's Dublin. Ever hear of Dublin? And I used to know Dublin when I was young, but it's all changed now. It's all one-way streets in the middle of downtown. And I had the use of a car this time when I was there, and I'm not used to driving a car in Ireland, but I was looking for a certain street, and any time I came anywhere near this particular street, the arrows were all pointing away, all one way. I thought, God, is there no way of getting to this place at all? Every angle I made at it from it. Couldn't. So I pulled into the curb, and I put the window down. There was a guy passing by, and I said, "Hey, Pat," I said, "how do I get to Thomas Street?" So he scratched his head, and he looked up the street, and he looked down the street, and he said, "Ah, Father," he said, "to get to Thomas Street, you wouldn't really start from here at all." He said. I knew I was home. I knew I was home. And there was a story going the rounds last year in Ireland about an American who had been over there on vacation. He was from Texas, this fellow. And he got in with this Irish farmer. And he asked the Irish farmer to show him around his little farm, which he did. And when the Texan saw the farm, he said, oh, gee, he said, you know, back in Texas, where I come from, we don't call them farms. We call it a ranch. A ranch. Give you an idea, he said, if I got up at sunrise on my ranch and got into my car to go around it, by the time the sun would have set, I wouldn't have got halfway around it. And the Irishman said, is that a fact, he said. You know, he said, I had a car like that once, too. Well, that's what they're like back there. They're all like that. You never know where you are with the Irish. I'll tell you one difference between an Irish alcoholic and any other alcoholic. You know, all of us, when we become alcoholics, we become bullshitters, huh? Well, an Irishman doesn't have to wait to become an alcoholic to become a bullshitter. That's the way we all are. Well, anyway, that's the kind of people I was born amongst long years ago. And I was born in a little Irish village down in the south of Ireland. That's very important. Not up in the north. You know, they're all crazy up there. They're all lunatics, a whole lot of them. Protestants, Catholics. Nuts. I was born in the south of Ireland, in a little Irish village where everybody was a Catholic because there was nothing else to be. And when I was a little kid, I was sent to school like everybody else in the village. And the nuns taught me when I went to the first school I went to. And then I graduated from there and I went to another school and I was taught by what they call the brothers. They're sort of male nuns, if you could imagine such a thing. Yes, they do. And then after that I was sent to what they call the classical school. That was a college. And the teachers there were all priests. So, as you can imagine, God save us, when I was a kid, I got God for breakfast, dinner, and every day, God. So I had a very sort of God-conscious upbringing. God was more real to me than the people I could see with my two eyes. He sort of haunted me. He was awful real to me as a child. And I can never remember making my mind up to become a priest. I never remember making my mind up. As far back as my memory takes me, to when I was a little nipper, I had already decided I was going to be a priest. And no one had ever suggested it to me or anything at all like that. And I don't know why, but that's the way I was as a youngster. Now, before I tell you my story, I want to tell you that when I came into this program, the first thing that impressed me about AA was when I saw the steps up on the wall, the 12 steps, for the very first time, I zeroed in on that second step, the one that says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I remember saying to myself, gee, they've all been insane in here in this place. They had to be all restored to sanity. And then it dawned on me, I said to myself, maybe that's what's been wrong with me all my life. that I've been insane all my life. And the more I thought of it, the more I was saying to myself, God, you know, if that's a fact, that would explain an awful lot. It really would. And the more I look back at my life now when I tell my story, the more I look back at it from my years in AA, the more convinced I become that I was insane from the very minute I was born. I really believe that more and more as I get older. And as I get more and more into AA, I believe that. And that's what I want to tell you in telling you my story. As I see it now, looking back, it's the story of an insane person. That's the way I see it. Maybe you won't see it that way. I don't know. But if you don't, you're in the right place. There are various kinds of nuts, various kinds of nuts. And I want to tell you straight away the kind of nut that I think now that I was then. There's different kinds of nuts. And the kind of nut that I was a religious nut. Yeah. There's religious nuts, just as there's all kinds of different nuts. So that's the kind I was, I think. Maybe you won't think so. And that's fine. That's fine. Keep coming back. Now, I've told you that as far back as I can recall, I had my mind made up that I was going to be a priest. I was a very weird little kid. When I was a little kid, I used to play with the other kids the way ordinary kids would. Do you know where I was? In the little village I lived in, the church was always open, all day. And that's where I used to be. I'd be down there in the church. Now, what the hell I was doing there, I'm not clear about in my own mind now at all. I used to light candles, get candles lit all over the place, get the whole... Maybe I was a pyromaniac, you know? I don't know. But I know I was not normal when I think back on it. And if you had asked me when I was a little kid, now why do you want to be a priest? Why that? I would have been a little bit embarrassed. I wouldn't have wanted to tell you. Because I had all kinds of thoughts and feelings inside me that I was very shy about letting anybody know about. But I tell you now, I'm not shy about it now. You see, I had heard, and by the way, there's another thing. If you're a nut, what you're told and what you hear isn't always the same thing. So I want you to allow for all those things as you're hearing my story. I remember hearing in school or somewhere, what's the biggest thing a human being can do with his life? Well, that's a good question, isn't it? What's the biggest thing you can do? Biggest thing of all that you can do? And I remember hearing the answer. The answer, they told me, is in the good book. That's the Bible, not this other thing. The good book. And the answer is, what's the biggest thing a human being can do with their life? The answer is to love God. The greatest and the first of all the commandments, of all the values, of all the things to aspire to, the greatest of them all is, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole heart and soul and mind and strength. Do that, And you've done a bigger thing than getting to the moon and back. You've done a bigger thing than making a million. You've done a bigger thing than finding the cure for cancer. Love God totally. It's the biggest thing a human being can do. I remember saying to myself, well, that's what we're going to do then. That's what we're going to do. And then if you had asked me, what do you do exactly in order to love God perfectly? What exactly do you do? Now, don't forget what I told you. What I was told and what I was heard wasn't the same thing. And the answer that I would have given you was, the first thing you have to do if you're going to love God perfectly is, you've got to make yourself as miserable as a human being can make it. You've got to afflict yourself. You've got to say no to everything that's enjoyable and pleasurable. You've got to be self-sacrificed. All that stuff. Deny yourself anything and everything. That's step one towards loving God. And then, if you want to go in for an honors course altogether in this business of loving God, then what you have to do is, you have to leave home, you have to leave your family and your possessions, and wife and parents and children and all that, renounce all that, and go way out foreign to convert the heathen. And so I thought to myself, Now don't forget, here I am being brought up at schools in the south of Ireland. I said to myself, now where in the world is the most heathen place in the world? You got it. England. That's what I have to do. And so, this is all true. At the ripe old age of 15, I packed my little bag, I stood on my little flat feet in front of my father and mother, and I said, I'm going to England. I'm going to go over there, and I heard of a monastery that was over there. I'm going to go to the prep school over there of that monastery, and then I'm going to be a monk in the monastery, and I'm going to be a priest eventually, and I'm going to convert the whole of England. Because they're all heathens. And that's exactly what I set out to do. My father, God rest his soul, brought me up to Dublin and put me on the little ship that goes across from Dublin to Liverpool, which is the biggest city in the north of England. And then I traveled from there to a place called the Yorkshire Moors, in the middle of which, in the middle of nowhere, there was this enormous big monastery with a prep school attached to it. And I started going to prep school, and then eventually I entered the monastery, and I became a monk, and I was ordained a priest, and I lived there in that monastery for 30 years. 30 years. Is it any wonder I wonder, am I nuts? Well, if I had time, I'd tell you all about life in the monastery. I'm sure you'd be sort of curious to know what goes on there. It was a wonderful life. Marvelous. I thought it was terrific for a certain time. Those monks were wonderful men. They get up at night, in the middle of the night, to go along to the Abbey Church to sing the praises of God at 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, if you want to know from me what the hell God wants his praises sung for at 2 o'clock in the morning, I don't know. But it seemed a good idea to me then. And when I say we got up out of bed, you haven't to picture a real bed. All it was each monk had his little cell. By the way, in a monastery, you don't live in a room, you live in a cell. Some of you may have... I don't know. The bed is just two boards on it, two trestles, two boards with a straw mattress and a straw pillow, and one very rough blanket, and that's it. And you just roll off at 2 o'clock in the morning, you tootle along to the Abbey Church, and you sing away there for an hour and a half, and you go back again, collapse on the straw mattress, and you're up again at 5:30, and you go, it's a life of prayer, a life of study, meditation, life of all kinds of, the fast 3 days in the week, and all the days of Lent, 40 days of Lent leading up to Easter. Oh, it's a life of great self-sacrifice. They take 3 vows, let me tell you. A vow of poverty, so that they won't own anything. Nobody owns anything. You don't own any money of your own or any, nothing at all. Everything is ours. Belongs to us. And, it's worse than when you're married. It's worse. And you take a vow of obedience, so that you never do what you want to do yourself. You always do whatever the boss man, he's the superior. And you regard what he wants you to do as the will of God. And then you take a vow of chastity, and that's all to do with renouncing marriage and romance and sex and all that lovely, lovely stuff. And the point of all that, by the way, the point of it all is to bring about what that third chapter in our big book talks about. Remember, it says there, ego has to be smashed. That's a shocking strong word, you know. Ego has to be smashed if we're ever to get close to God, or God's to get close to us. And that's the whole idea about everything that goes on in a monastery. Anyway, that was the life I lived, and it was a very happy life until... Now we're going to start drinking. Now it gets interesting, right? When I was 30 years of age, that was the year 1950. Now work out quick now what age I am now, you see. When I was 30 years of age, it was the year 1950, and that was 5 years after the end of the Second World War in Europe. Second World War in Europe ended in 1945. Long, long before most of you were a gleam in your daddy's eye. And Europe was getting back to normal after the whole business of the war. And the Roman Catholic Church authorities resumed doing what they had always done for centuries, because it was interrupted by the war. They resumed sending young priests who showed some signs of having a bit of brains of some kind, sending young priests to Rome, to those big universities there, in order to study all kinds of highfalutin stuff. And so, my superior sent me to Rome in 1950 to go to what they call a pontifical university to study all sorts of stuff. And so I found myself living in this big monastery in Rome, which was a head monastery of the religious order that I belonged to. Now, in this monastery, you had monks from all over the world. Most of them, guys like myself, young ones, sent by their superiors to study in Rome. But you also had the resident Italian community. And so that life in that monastery was run on Italian lines, when in Rome you do as Rome does. And so, the Italians, they don't drink lemonade and... water, they never drink water. Some of them don't hardly use water at all for any purpose. Well, there were 2 meals a day in the big central room of this monastery. That's called the refectory. You'd call it a dining room. 2 meals a day. And all the monks would file in there to these tables, very bare, dark, coarse, no table cloths. And you'd always sit in exactly the same place. And so you'd have the same guy either side of you. You went in there according to your seniority, like in the service, you know. And so I used to find myself twice a day at these two meals in this big dining room, and all down the middle of these bare tables were these enormous flagons of wine, huge things, and they were positioned one between each of two monks. Now, they'd be put out there in the same way that you'd put out a pitcher of, big pitcher of water. You weren't meant to drink the whole pitcher. But anyway, I found myself within arm's reach of two of these things. One here that was supposed to be between me and the fellow beside me here. Now, this fellow beside me, at each meal, he would only take that much in the bottom of a glass. Now, there was that one there that this fellow here was supposed to share with the fellow the other side of him. Now, this fellow here, he never took any at all. He was weird. He wasn't normal. And the fellow the far side of him, he only took a little in. So, twice a day, two enormous flagons of real strong Italian wine. Now, I had never been drunk in my entire life up to this point. Never. I had no idea what being drunk meant, what it felt like. Well, I want to tell you, at every meal, I was always terribly thirsty. And I couldn't eat the Italian food at all. My stomach was always empty. And at the end of every meal, those two flagons were empty. And I was as high as a kite. Totally smashed. No one had ever told me what happens when you get drunk. No one had ever told me before. But all I know is that about three-quarter ways through each meal, by the way, the meals were always taken in dead, dead silence. The holy monks, total silence. Well, Everything started looking awful strange to me. And everything was hilarious. This was so funny. And the guys each time were digging me in the ribs, shut up. And I was roaring and enjoying it. What the hell? Well, that didn't go down too well with the monks at all. And it was always a terrible problem to me, though, at every meal, because when they did prevail on me to shut up and keep quiet, I always had one enormous problem at the end of each meal, because the monks would all get up, you see, from their place and line up along the tables to say these prayers, and then we had to walk out in a straight line. It was a terrible problem, because I had to tack against the wind all the time. All my problems started then. I had over 25 years of drinking problems from that point on. I became an alcoholic the very, very first time I ever drank. Very first time. I enjoyed that stuff like I couldn't describe to you. I mean enjoyed it. God, it was a lovely feeling. It was glorious. Fantastic. But I want to tell you, that experience having my meals each day was only the beginning of the thing, because, like I said, there were guys there from all over the world, and so there were a lot of English-speaking ones, like from America, Australia, Canada, Ireland, England, and so on. And we formed a little community of our own inside this big international community. Because, you see, we were far from home, very far from home, and all these guys around us there in that place, they were all talking Italian and Spanish and German and French. They were all barbarians. You couldn't communicate with these people at all. So we had to club together, you see, and keep ourselves civilized and keep ourselves cheered up a bit. And we did have money from our superiors back home to buy books and to do deep research at university. You know. But he didn't need all the money for that. And so, to make a long story short, we laid in what was necessary to keep ourselves cheered up, you see. And, well, we had to keep all the boodle somewhere, so they entrusted me with keeping the supplies supplied. And they made my room. They made my cell the meeting place for these surreptitious secret meetings and parties that we had at all hours of the day and night. And so I had literally rows of shelves with bottles of good stuff, with a blanket discreetly placed over the shelves in my cell. And then we co-opted one Italian young monk into our group. His family owned a winery outside of Rome. And I lived to see the day when we got this huge barrel up the back stairs of the monastery and along the hallway and into my cell. And there I had this huge barrel with a faucet on it. Everything all laid out in my room. And rows of bottles on the shelves. This was my honeymoon with alcohol. They were wonderful years. My first years with alcohol. Utterly unbelievable. I was a very studious kind of student. I didn't go out much. I stayed in my room an awful lot. And I studied a lot. I wrote a doctorate dissertation. And when I read it now, I don't know what the hell it means. No idea. I really mean this. I do not know what it means. It was written entirely under some kind of inspiration. Either the Holy Spirit or some sort of spirit had something to do with it. But anyway, that was my life for 3 years. A life of... I was constantly drunk. Constantly drunk. Can you imagine that? I was constantly drunk for 3 years. That's not an exaggeration. Alcohol was never out of my bloodstream for 3 solid years. And anyway, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it immensely. I never enjoyed anything more in my whole life. I eventually got whatever doctor had sent me out there to get, and I came home. It means I got back to my monastery. I was appointed to teach. And now I'm going to tell you, I was launched into a new phase of my life, and I was going to become the most brilliant professor that the Roman Catholic Church had ever produced in its known history. And I was going to put the Roman Catholic Church and the whole of England, and as a matter of fact, the whole universe right about everything. Everything. I had all the answers. Now, it may occur to you that a personality change had set in. Definitely. I wasn't aware of the fact that it had, but looking back now, I know that that's what happened. I had become dependent on alcohol. When I was appointed to teach and started my teaching career, I discovered that I couldn't function at all without the stuff. Couldn't function without it. And so I became a closet drinker in a regular, habitual way. I always had my supply. Always. Now, if you want to know from me, how in the world a guy living the life of a monk in a monastery in the circumstances I've indicated to you already could always have his own supply of booze in his room. I told you about the vow of poverty. I had no money of my own. Told you about the vow of obedience. I couldn't go in and out of that place except at the behest of the boss man. Where are you going and all that. How did a guy like that always have his supply? Well, I'll tell you straight away that I learned to live a day at a time long before I ever met you guys. And I can tell you it works. It works. But what I haven't told you about that kind of life I lived was those monks did a very specialized kind of external work outside the monastery. I'll tell you what that work consisted in. You know that in every town and village and city and so on, there's Catholic churches, and they are run by priests who, that's their life, running those churches and those parishes. Well now, way back in those days that I'm talking about now, priests running the churches in those parishes would apply to a monastery like the monastery I lived in for one or two of those monks to come to the churches in the parishes and to stay in those parishes, so one or two or three monks stay there in the parishes for two or three weeks, and all the people in those days would crowd into the churches, and those monks would preach every night, and there was what they call parish missions. And these monks were looked on as sort of real holy men of God who lived these lives in the monasteries wrapped up in prayer with God, like Moses in the Bible was wrapped up in prayer with God on the top of the mountain, and then he'd come down from the mountain to the people and speak God's mind and God's heart to the people. This is the idea they had of those monks in those days. And so I'd be sent out on those kind of jobs to a parish for two or three weeks to preach to the people, and the parish priest, the pastor would notice that the Holy Father, I was the Holy Father, you see, he needed plenty of the Spirit to keep going, and he made sure that the Holy Father got as much of the Spirit as he needed. And when I'd be going back to my monastery then, well, he'd give me a couple of bottles to put in my bag, because the bottle's the good stuff, or he'd even give me a backhander to keep myself supplied, apart from the offering he'd give me to bring back to the monastery, he'd give me something for myself, and I could supply myself with what he gave. I want you to notice that by this time, an awful lot of this business about loving God perfectly had gone on the back burner. We've got to be practical now. We've got to get on with the business of living, don't you understand? And an awful lot of that holy stuff had gone on the back burner in my case. And as well as going out, you see, on those trips to those parishes where I used to get plenty of the good stuff to bring home with me, those kind of monks would be sent to convents with nuns, big communities of nuns that we used to have in the old days, to give what they call retreats to the nuns. And the Reverend Mother would notice, oh my goodness, the good father, she'd leave a bottle of the stuff in my room, you see, and that bottle would be gone in half a day. And she'd leave another one that night, and that was gone by morning. She got the message awful fast. And she'd make sure that the good father would have something to bring home with him too. So it was all quite manageable. I had my supply pretty constantly. I never had any problem about it. But it involved, as you can see a mile off, forgetting about these holy vows I had taken to be a poor man and to be detached and all that good stuff. Well, 25 years of my life from this point on was a life of an alcoholic. The life that that big book describes to absolute perfection. That big book is all about me. I have to tell you, for those 25 years, I wish I didn't have to tell you about it. I'm not proud of them. They were the most miserable years I think any man could have ever lived. They were miserable years. Sure, I had a total personality change, but I thought that it was everyone else who had changed. I had become arrogant, bad-tempered, mean, obnoxious. People remarked it to me, "You used to be a halfway decent kind of guy. Now you're just a thoroughgoing bastard. That's all you are, whatever has come over you." And you know, I used to look at myself when I'd be shaving and talk to myself. I remember saying to myself, "What the hell do they expect? They send me to Rome to study. I become a very brilliant man. Of course I'm changed. What the hell do they expect? If they'd only have the damn sense to listen to what I'm saying and do the kind of things I'm telling them to do, and pay the attention to me that I deserve to have paid attention to me, things would be all right around here." That's the way I saw it. I wasn't teaching very long when the boss man sent for me. And I tootled along to his office. I was wondering what promotion he had in mind for me. But when I walked in, I saw that there were clouds on the horizon. He was very, very short and to the point. He said, "I want you to know, Father, the worst day's work I ever did was to send you to Rome. All it has done for you is, it has made you an alcoholic. Did you hear that dirty word?" That was the first time ever that that filthy, filthy word was addressed to me, about me. All it did for you was, it made you an alcoholic. And I want you to understand that your conduct has been deplorable and scandalous. Your conduct in class with the young men has been absolutely outrageous. You have been drunk and foul-mouthed. And I want you to understand that as of this moment, your teaching assignment is terminated, and it's terminated permanently, and I will see to it that you will never again occupy a chair of philosophy or theology or scripture or anything else anywhere in the Catholic Church. And now, Father, you may go. That was a thunderclap. And I can't find words to tell you how that made me feel. I was absolutely shattered. Absolutely shattered. I couldn't believe my ears. And I staggered out of his office. And I met some of my colleagues in the hallway outside. I remember distinctly saying to them, "You'll never believe what that jackass has just told me. I'm an alcoholic. Just because I enjoy a drink, I'm an alcoholic." And they didn't express the slightest sympathy towards me. Well, I was reduced in the ranks. I was required to do just the ordinary duties that you needed, as I thought, no brains whatever for doing. And now, from that point on, my story is the story of an embittered, hate-filled, resentful, vain pain in the ass. I was a kind of maudlin drunk who would buttonhole you if you were fool enough to pay any attention to me at any hour of the day or night and start in to tell you about what those so-and-sos had done to me. I became an absolute phony and a hypocrite. I was sent out on those kind of chores or jobs I told you about. And I would get up there in church and I'd preach your head off. Very impressive, very eloquent, very wonderful. Telling people how to love God with their whole heart. How to love one another the way God wants us to. How to be humble, tolerant, forgiving, honest. And all the time, every single sentence that I was saying was a condemnation of myself. And I knew it. I was the ultimate actor. The ultimate Jekyll and Hyde. And the terrible thing about it is that I was successful at it. Humanly speaking, successful. It's incredible. I remember preaching on Good Friday in Westminster Cathedral in the middle of London to a crowd of, I think it was about 4,000 people who were packed in there. And the Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster was up on his throne and all kinds of important people. And I came down out of that pulpit and the guy in charge of things met me when I came down and conducted me into the wings away from and shook my hand and all this stuff. And he said, what can I give you, Father? It's simply fantastic. I said, you can give me the biggest bumper of whiskey that you can get right now, I said. I went to bed, I remember, blind drunk that night, but I remember my last thought as I was lapsing off into oblivion. I had talked about what had happened on Good Friday, what had been said to the man who died on the cross. He saved others, but himself, he cannot save. I remember thinking, that's going to be your epitaph, buddy. I was a dramatizer. I would even dramatize to myself, talk poetry to myself. The ultimate phony actor. I remember sitting in the confessional, hearing people's confessions. Inside, I knew in the parish house the bottle would be out. This is in the. And let's get the hell out of here! Of course, the phone was always ringing in the bishop's office or the pastor's office or someone's office. And the cure was always move him on, get him out of here. It'll take me a long time to tell you how it came about that I had to ask the Pope, no less, to annul my vows as a monk. I couldn't stand the unsatisfactoriness of my life, that I wasn't given the recognition that I deserved, don't you understand? And that my potential and my talents and my brilliance was not being used the way it should be used. So I petitioned the Pope to give me an annulment of my vows as a monk, and the big brass of the religious order jumped to it and encouraged him to do it. And I had to remain a priest, and so I pulled wires in different directions. I ended up coming out here to join this Diocese of San Diego over 20 years ago. Someone told the Bishop of San Diego that there was a brilliant man that he really should bring on board into his diocese. He has regretted it since. And I brought my problem out here with me. in 1968. And it was the same old story when I came out here. But it all ended up with my going on a vacation with a Catholic family that befriended me. They brought me on a vacation with the family down to, wait for it, Ensenada. If you ever want a bottom out drinking, go to Ensenada. I found myself in a big trailer that they had down there. And by the way, I chose my friends very carefully, any friends I ever had, because once again, the wife of this family belonged herself to a family that owned a winery. And so they had plenty of the good stuff, always had. And I was down with them there on vacation and drinking like a fish as usual. And it came, oh yes, I remember. The wife developed tennis elbow, and the husband had to bring her back up here to San Diego to have that attended to. And that left Uncle Bill in charge down in the trailer. And the kids were, there was a good number of them, I forget, but the eldest of them was a college-age kid, about 23, 24. And there was a whole crowd of them going away down to a little nipper. A good Catholic family, don't you understand? You know what I mean. Well, Uncle Bill was in charge, and it came very late at night, this particular night, and the radio had been blaring away all day and all night there, and I had been drinking all day as usual, but I upended the bottle into my glass and threw the bottle into the trash can. Now, this was the most important drink of the day. The last one to take the beverages that are going to pass out with, right? That's the important one. And so I said, now let's get that radio switched off and let's have peace and quiet around here and let's all go to our beds and have some peace and quiet. So they switched off the radio and I got up and I started tacking again the wind to get over to the corner where my bunk was, and the eldest son, Matt, positioned himself between me and my bunk, and he put his thumbs into his belt, and he looked at me in a very hostile way, and he blocked my way to my bunk, and he said to me, "Where do you think you're going?" "Oh," I said, "I'm going to bed. Where else?" He said, no, you're not. Not with that." And he pointed to the bumper of whiskey in my hand. I said, "Who said I'm not?" He said, "I did. And I'm going to say something else, buddy," he said. "I'm going to say something that needs to be said to you. You shouldn't drink at all. Because all you are is an ignorant, savage, Irish alcoholic." Did you hear that? Did you hear that dirty word? That's the second time in 25 years that filthy word was thrown at me. And this time by a young punk. 23-year-old talking to a doctor of theology. Doctor of theology? Doctor of canon law? Doctor of... Who the... And he said, "I haven't finished." "You come around my family on a regular basis, freeloading, getting your free booze, as if you had some God-given right to it. You think because you wear a bloody collar back to front, you have a God-given right to all this booze that you get from my family? I've news for you," he said. "You're not welcome around here. And that goes not just for me, but for my brothers and sisters here, doesn't it?" And the whole damn lot of them said, "Yes." "And it also goes for my mother and father, who are too damn decent to tell it to you at your face. But it comes from them through me, too. And the sooner you get lost and get to hell across the horizon and never be seen around here again, the better we'll all be pleased. Did I tell you that I'm a very brilliant man? Did I get that in telling you my story? Did I tell you that I went to school with the man who today is the Pope himself? Did I tell you guys that yet? I did. Well, that's the truth. And here's this young brat talking to me in these terms. I couldn't believe my ears. I made to get past him with dignity. And he made a grab at the glass of whiskey, and he knocked it out of my hand. The last whiskey in the house that I was going to pass out with. And when that happened, something happened inside here. I never know how to tell this part of my story because the words just aren't there. It's terrible what happened. Terrible. I'll never forget it. Something exploded in there. There was an explosion. A real explosion. And I was just totally carried away with fury, rage, that I can't describe. I've never had a feeling like it. And all I wanted to do was to get a hold of that punk's throat, put my fingers around him, and squeeze till the eyes bulged out of his head, until he went purple and dropped. That's all I wanted to do. And I made for him. And I went for the jugular. And the whole crowd of the rest of them were screaming and hollering and roaring like you never heard. And they dragged me off of him. I stampeded around that trailer and smashed everything in sight. And I stormed out of there and went up the beach to where I knew there was a bar still open. And I bought my last bottle. I pray to God it will have been my last bottle. And I drank it that night. And of course I passed out totally on the beach. This is the 8th of September, 1975, my sobriety date. I woke up somewhere half through the morning the next day. I remembered what had happened the previous night. I remembered it. I stood up and I looked out at the ocean, looked out at the waves. And I remember the first time I had ever seen waves. I had a recall. First time I'd ever seen waves, what I was looking at then, was when I was on that little ship going across to England, a 15-year-old little boy, an innocent little boy, setting out to love God perfectly. And I remember saying to myself, "You've come a long way, baby. Come a long way." "Do you realize," I said to myself, "you wanted to murder a man last night? You actually wanted to murder somebody. You really did. And you probably would have if there had been nobody else there. You wanted to murder somebody. All because of booze. Booze, booze." And I had a kind of a vision of all my years stretching away back to my very first drink. All the madness I had been involved in. All the utter craziness. The pitiable and incomprehensible demoralization. The places I'd been in, the company I'd been in, the things I had done. I know what pitiable and incomprehensible demoralization is all about. I had never had the courage to get the hell out of the job altogether. But I went in for sex in substitute ways that were
God, sickening and shameful. And the whole thing closed in on me when I was looking out at those waves down in Ensenada. I said, God, where are you going to end up? Would you look the way your life is going, has gone. You're not going to quit drinking, you know. You've tried to, and that was true. But you're not going to. You're caught. And the way you're going on, you either will kill someone someday with the kind of temper you have, or someone will kill you with the kind of situations you get yourself into. So you can't go on living without it, and you're not going to go on living with it. What you gonna do? I felt trapped. I saw a ghost. The cold sweat broke out on me. And I didn't know what the hell to do. And for the first time in years, I just looked up at the blue sky and I said, are you there? God, help me. I'm frightened. I could see the trailer over in the distance. And I saw that the kids had left the trailer. And I had my car there. And when I knew they weren't in the trailer, I went back and I collected my belongings, bundled it into the car, and came back up to San Diego. And I had a commitment to do a preaching job up in Los Angeles the next day. The vacation was over. And I wanted to do something that I hadn't done in years. I wanted to go to confession. I wanted to get rid of some garbage that was killing me. I didn't know what the hell I was going to do about my drinking, but I was frightened. And I didn't want to go to confession to any priest who knew me. And I had the directory of the clergy up in Los Angeles who don't know me from Adam and that I don't know. And I just looked at addresses, and I figured on a place that I thought I would be able to get to off the freeway without getting lost. And I headed for that address, and I found it. And I stood on the doorstep of this little rectory, and I rang the doorbell. And a priest answered. I was in my priest stuff at this time, and priest answered the door, an oldish looking guy. And I said to him, Father, I said, would you hear my confession, please? Oh, he said, Father, you sure, come in. I went into his little sitting room and he sat down in his armchair and I knelt down at his elbow. I was shaking. I was perspiring from every pore. Cold, oh, that awful sweat. Stinking, stinking, stinking. And I just knelt there and I tried to tell him whatever I could remember of what I call my crimes. It was shameful. It was filthy. It was horrible. It was just absolutely ghastly. And when I was through, he looked at me in a kind of a bored sort of way. And he said to me, what brought you here to me with all this stuff? I said, well, I came here to get God's forgiveness for my sins. What else? Oh, he said, I know, but why did you pick on me? Oh, I said, because you don't know me, I hope. Oh, he said, you needn't worry, I don't. And furthermore, I don't want to. But he said, I know a heck of a lot more about you than you know. Matter of fact, I know all about you. That matters. I know exactly what's wrong with you. All that's wrong with you is, you're an alcoholic, and you don't like hearing it, like every alcoholic doesn't. That's part of the disease. And it is a disease. It's a sickness that you yourself are not responsible for. And he started in to tell me about this business of alcohol is a drug, you're allergic to the drug, it has gone all through your bloodstream, it has gone through your brain 1,000 times, it has altered your brain, damaged it, your brain is your thinking box, it has programmed you to think all kinds of shit. And to think that you're thinking all kinds of wisdom. It has programmed you to think self-destructively and to act self-destructively. All this stuff you've been confessing here, he says, there isn't a damn sin in it from start to finish, because you are programmed to carry on that way. Programmed to by this drug that you're allergic to. It would have been a miracle if you didn't carry on all that way. And I thought to myself when I was kneeling there, my God, what have I walked into here? Are there two lunatics in this room? Or only one? And if one, which? I didn't know what to think. You know, it says in the big book, we stood at a turning point, I knelt at the turning point. I didn't know whether to stand up and close my fist and let them have it in the teeth and say, look here, I'm in mortal sin. If I died with these sins on me, I'd be damned forever. Now you give me God's forgiveness and stop giving me this chloroform. Or whether to stay there and listen. And something said to me, listen, you fool, listen to what you're being told. And then he said something that really clinched it for me. He said, you think that you came here by some kind of a fluke. You told me about looking at addresses or something. He said, you didn't come here by any kind of a fluke. You were brought here, he said. You were brought here by the scruff of the neck. I am certain of that, he said. I'll tell you how I know. I'm an alcoholic. Chronic alcoholic, for years longer than you. And I'm a recovering alcoholic in an outfit called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he started to tell me about this Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the only remedy for what's wrong with you. The only remedy on this planet for what's wrong with you. And it is the remedy. But the remedy will only work if you believe what I'm telling you right here and now about yourself. That you are not responsible for all this stuff that you've been confessing. No sins in it, not one, not a bit. None. You couldn't commit a sin. He said, to commit a sin, he said, you have to be a mature, responsible human being. So you needn't worry. You're just nuts. You're just suffering from a terrible disease. You're a puppet on a string. You're a puppet on a string with booze telling you to do all this. And you can't resist it. But he said, the remedy works. The remedy works if you accept what I'm telling you about yourself. And he said, you think you came here by a fluke? Let me tell you this. I am the only priest who is himself an alcoholic in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for miles around here. And you think you came here by a fluke? He said, if you believe that, you're even sicker than you look. Now he said, you know, I want to tell you guys, when Catholics go to confession, they get what they call a penance. They have to do some prayers. He said, for your penance for this lot, bucko, he said, you're not going to get three Hail Marys or three rosaries. And that's there. He said, for your penance, you get your ass to an AA meeting. This very night. And I did. He took me. And he phoned my boss. And then I was taken away, good man, thanks. I was taken away, I was sent away off to a recovery place, and I came home, and I've been with you guys ever since. And I want to finish by telling you what you guys helped me to find out about me. And this is the best part of my story. This is the best part of my story, and the most unbelievable part. When I got myself a sponsor, my sponsor had no religion of any kind, but boy, did he have serenity. He was a wonderful AA guy, fantastic guy. He's gone to God now, lovely guy. But he was tough. And he said to me, if you want me to be your sponsor, and I don't like the job at all, I want you to know. He said, you phone me twice a day, and you tell me what's going on inside you, what you're feeling, what's going on around you, who you met, what you said, what happened, blah, blah, blah. And tell me all that twice a day, and I'll tell you what you think about all that, and you think it. Read the big book, go to meetings, blah, 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 all the usual stuff. So after a while, he said, now, have you read the big book? Yeah, I said, yes, I have. He said, did you read the chapter of the agnostic? I said, you know the job I'm in, Richard. Did you read the chapter? No, Richard, I said, no. Well, read the thing, he said. So I did. And I'm here to tell you that I have never in all my entire life read anything that comes within a million miles of comparing with the wisdom that's in that chapter. Now, I told you I was 30 years a monk reading all kinds of spirituality that you wouldn't believe. I was 3 years in a pontifical university studying all kinds of, you wouldn't know what. I have never in my life read anything like the chapter of the agnostic of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That chapter, my sponsor explained to me, you won't read what's in that chapter if you start out with the belief that the chapter is designed to try to get you to believe that there's a God. That's not what the chapter is about at all. It does not set out to try to prove to you or me that there's a God. It sets out to do something entirely different. It sets out to try to get people like you and me to do something very, very simple, which will make it possible for God to prove to me that there is a God. And that's something different altogether. What it does is, it says to us, look at the world we're living in. Isn't it really mysterious? Isn't it really wonderful? Wonderful. You throw a seed in the ground and a flower grows. You know, that's wonderful. So wonder. Birds lay eggs. The eggs turn into birds and fly away. That's wonderful. So wonder. Men and women do what men and women do 9 months before a little human being appears. That's wonderful. The thing is mind-boggling. So wonder, that's all wonder. Did it all come about by accident? Or did someone design it, make it come about? Wonder, that's all wonder. Maybe there is a God, maybe there isn't. How do you make the transition from saying to yourself, maybe there is, to saying, I know there is. I know it without a shadow of doubt. He tells you how. We finally came to see that faith in some kind of God might not, after all, be as irrational as we had hitherto supposed. But how to make the transition from wondering is there to realizing there is. We had to search fearlessly. And my sponsor said to me, does that remind you of any step? I said, yeah, the fourth step. Brilliant. He said, keep coming back. We had to search fearlessly, but he was there. Where? Where? We found the great reality deep down within our own selves. In the last analysis, it is only there he can be found. And when found, he was as much a fact as we ourselves were. Are you listening to that? They're the greatest sentences anywhere in the world, in the planet. I'm telling you how to find what we're all looking to find. And when found, he was as much a fact as we ourselves were. I'm pretty sure that I'm a fact, that I didn't dream myself up. Sometimes I've doubts about you. But I'm pretty sure that I'm a fact. And here's this guy telling me that I can be as sure that God is a fact as I am that I'm a fact myself. That's pretty sure, you know. How do you get to be that sure? Did you? Take your fourth step. Get in touch with all the garbage. Because when you get in touch with your garbage, what are you getting in touch with? The areas of your own powerlessness. my powerlessness to quit drinking, drugging. My powerlessness to be satisfied with my lot in life, not to be resentful about it. My powerlessness over my lusts. My powerlessness over my ambition, my self-importance, my resentments, my hates, my bitternesses, my jealousies. My powerlessness in so many areas. And when I get in touch with all that, what do I do with it? I have to say, are you there? Help me with this. It's killing me. I want you to. I want you to. I want you to. And as sure as you do, in his good time, you will find yourself being empowered to be the kind of person you're powerless to be. You'll find yourself being empowered not to want to be the kind of person you can't stop yourself being. You'll find yourself answering the phone some fine day, and there'll be someone at the other end of that phone whose guts you hate. And you're going to find yourself saying, oh, yeah? Oh, that's what you want? Oh, sure, that's fine by me. Oh, yeah, I'd be delighted. Yeah. Yeah, sure. Put the phone down, you go across the room, and halfway across, you stop dead. My God, was that really me? I can't believe it. We don't change ourselves. We can't. We become changed. We are changed by a power greater than ourselves. And when you find yourself being empowered to be the kind of person you're powerless to be, then you know there's a power greater than yourself. There's no other way for knowing. There never was and there never will be. It's like walking on water. It's like finding yourself upheld in mid-air and not falling down. It's weird. And when you find yourself enjoying being this different kind of person, then you know that whatever it is empowering you, loves you. When I was a little kid, sometimes I'd be out playing in the backyard with the kids, and I'd come in all dirt, cut, clothes torn. My mother would say, you poor kid. And she'd wash me, change my clothes, comb my hair, make me feel all silky and rosy and nice. She cleaned up my mess and she made me feel good. That's how I found out my mother loved me. I didn't work it out with my mind. I experienced it. I experienced it by having her clean up my mess and make me feel good. That's how I found out there is a somebody who has cleaned up my mess and made me feel good about me being me. I discovered when I came to this program that for all my life up to then, I had been an agnostic. I did not believe in a power greater than myself. If you'd asked me in my drinking years, this God that you preach about, that you pray to, that all this stuff, do you think that that God of yours could make you stop wanting to drink? Oh, now let's talk sense. That he could make you content with your lot in life, enjoy it, and not just endure it. Oh, don't talk nonsense. I didn't believe there was a power greater than me that could do to me and for me what I can't do. But now I know there is. And I enjoy being the different kind of person I am. It's a strange thing to have set out in life wanting to love God perfectly and to discover you never believed in a loving God at all. How do you say thanks to the people who have given you what you've always wanted in life? That's what I have to do every time I talk to my fellow AAs. You're marvelous people. You're the greatest people in my life. You've given me what they couldn't give me in a monastery. What they couldn't give me in a big university in Rome. What they couldn't give me anywhere in the outfit I belong to. You've given me all that matters to me in life. the people in this program that I identify with are the people who have loved happily, and then the whole thing turns sour through booze and drugs, and you lost it. And you know what it's like to get it all back again. That's what I want to thank you for. Thank you for giving me God, and every day I thank God for giving you, me, all of you. I love you. Good night, and God bless you.